Now, it's a nice-looking day, sunshine, blue sky, but it's cold. Wind is from the northwest at 8 miles per hour. And here are the current temperatures, minus 6 now for both Racine and Kenosha. It is 11 below for Burlington, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, 2 below in Milwaukee. Wind chill is about 21 below. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. WGTD News Time, 8:10. Morning Show with Greg Berg is next.
Support for WGTD's morning show comes from the generosity of the family and friends of the late Frank and Beverly Falduto, two lifelong Kenoshans who devoted much of their lives to the community in general and to WGTD in particular. Mr. Falduto played an essential role in creating WGTD nearly 40 years ago and later served as station manager and occasional morning show co-host. And we welcome you to the Monday morning show. I'm Gregory Berg. We have two interviews for you. The first with one of America's finest tenors, Brandon Jovanovich, who is about to open the Lyric Opera of Chicago in a fascinating new opera based in the Holocaust. In part two of today's program, you're going to be hearing from an antiques appraiser by the name of Mark Moran, who is presiding over an antiques appraisal event coming up this Saturday at the Kenosha Public Museum. Stay with us for the morning show on WGTD. For over a quarter century now, I have been a season ticket subscriber to the Lyric Opera of Chicago. And in that time, I have enjoyed a lot of great voices from that great stage and in that great hall. And one of the best tenor voices I've had the pleasure of hearing belongs to a strapping American by the name of Brandon Jovanovich. And I have enjoyed him in several different productions and look forward again to hearing him tomorrow night at the Lyric, singing in a Lyric premiere, an American premiere, a little-known but many call an undiscovered masterpiece called The Passenger by a little-known composer by the name of Weinberg. And Brandon Jovanovich has one of the leading roles in that production, and so we're going to be talking with him about that and some of the interesting experiences he's had through the course of a thriving and exciting career. Tenor Brandon Jovanovich, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Good to be talking to you. And I know that you, from reading in a Lyric Opera publication, that you actually make your home on a farm about an hour west of Chicago. So we're interrupting an idyllic afternoon on the farm, I think. But I appreciate the fact that you are allowing the interruption.
Please. I tell you, I'm not outside doing much in this cold, so it's no problem.
Very good. Good to be talking to you. Let's talk about this exciting opera that you are about to sing in called The Passenger. And first of all, what's it like when the phone rings or an email comes from your manager and an opportunity comes along for you to have a leading role in an opera that, in this case, I'm guessing you'd never even heard of? I mean, what's the process for you in terms of figuring out whether or not you even want to say yes to an opportunity like this?
Yeah, you know, it's always an interesting proposition whenever somebody calls up or my agent gets in touch with me and tells me that someone wants me to do something new. And if I'm free, for the most part, I enjoy singing pieces that are not necessarily the most of your standard rep. It's kind of always a challenge, and it's something that I think is important in keeping this art form alive and relevant. So I was excited to hear. I'd actually heard rumblings about The Passenger. I was in the director. His name's David Poutney. He was in Bregenz. He ran the Bregenz Festival for a few years, and I happened to be there singing in a Tosca production in 2007. When I had heard mention of The Passenger, and then I believe they premiered it in 2010. And And so I had heard a little bit about it. And so when I had the opportunity to sing it, and I thought it was a great reason for me to be in Chicago, a great way to stay at home, and a great way to present this really, really fascinating and amazing and relevant work to the public.
Very good. I might have said it's receiving its American premiere. I think I actually misspoke. Its Midwestern premiere is with this lyric opera production. I think it was actually first done by the Houston Grand Opera maybe a couple of years ago.
That's right. Exactly.
So when you get this kind of opportunity, then I suppose you eagerly await that score to arrive in the mail or over email or however one receives an opera score nowadays. And did you have a chance to listen to this work first and to carefully examine it before saying, yes, this fits me well, this particular role?
You know, yeah, what they do is they send me, usually if it's a newer piece that I'm not familiar with, I'll try to find a recording of it. In this case, I couldn't actually. I couldn't get anything in time to say yes before I said yes, I couldn't necessarily listen to it. But what I'd like to do is get the score. I look over my part in particular just to make sure that it doesn't lie too high or too low. You know, extremes that you touch upon are always possible. I mean, that's not really a problem. But if something lies consistently high, it kind of requires, for the most part, a lighter sort of a voice. If it's consistently low in the tenor range, well, actually, that's something I can do fairly easy. But this lies, it needs a little... it has a lot of actual textures to it, so that you need a somewhat of a heftier voice at times to sing this high declamatory sort of singing. And then it also lies rather low, where it's the shocked proclamations and hushed whispering that you're trying to come to terms with all the information that in this opera my wife is telling me. So I perused the score a little bit and was able to ascertain that I could sing this role and do a pretty good job of it. So I'm really happy.
Cool. Tell our listeners a little bit about the story. It has its roots in the Holocaust, but it takes wing in a very interesting way. Tell our listeners about just the basic framework of this story.
Sure. You know, it started... Forgive me if I forget the lady's name, but she was a actual Holocaust survivor, and she was walking down the street in Poland, I believe, and where she's from, and she thought she heard a voice of one of her Nazi guards on the street, and she froze. She said she froze with fear, you know, it was tingling up and down the spine. She didn't know what she was going to do, and she looked around frantically trying to find this person. She thought for sure it was her, but it wasn't. And that got her to thinking. She started thinking about what it would be like if she were to meet her again. What would she say? Because in her estimation, there were three types of guards. There were those that were very brutal and just wanted to inflict pain and fear. Then there were those that she said were wrapped up in this whole experience. And she called them accountants or store clerks. And just your normal people that were now had to be part of the army. And then she said there were very, very few that actually took an interest in you as a human being. And that's what she considered this one lady. But she was still her guard and at times inflicted mental anguish on her if she could. And so she started to formulate this idea in her head of what it would be like on the guard side of life to look at the experience through the guard's eyes. And so she ended up writing a short story about it, and then it went on the air, and it played in Poland as a reoccurring radio show. And it was eventually listened to by Shostakovich, a Russian composer, and he mentioned it to Weinberg. Weinberg, the composer of the opera, got a hold of this story. He got a librettist for it, and they ended up formulating this story. So it takes place in the 60s, where this husband and wife are on a cruise. He's a diplomat. They're heading over to Brazil to be, he's going to be the consulate over there, the German consulate. And the wife thinks she's seen somebody from her past that she knows, and she's very cold and frigid and very fearful. And it comes out through the the first 30 minutes of the opera that she used to be a Nazi overseer, and that she believes she's seen her old prisoner of hers. And so there's a series of flashbacks that occur, and you see the relationship that the two of them had. And in the end, it comes back to the present day, and we try to find a solution to the problem of what will happen once if word gets out about the fact that she was a Nazi overseer. And I won't spoil the end of the opera, but it's a very fascinating view of history, and it, I think it's still very relevant today about the fear and the apprehension one would hold doing deeds in the name of serving a country. And I think it's really, really fascinating opera.
Wow. What does it sound like musically?
You know, it's a real amalgam of many different styles. It's funny that the 60s were an interesting time anyway. It's a real transitional, or I don't even know transitional. Opera at the time was trying to find a footing, and this guy was experimenting with a lot of things. So there's some jazzy, swingy sort of moments in the opera, especially where I'm concerned. There's some real dissonance at times to create an atmospheric sort of a palette upon which voices then sing. And then there's also some real melodic and heavy orchestration that is more reminiscent of. Oh gosh, you know, Wagner or something with some motifs and themes. It really spans a wide array of styles, and more than anything, though, I would say it's very atmospheric. It really tries to evoke a sense of suspense, and he was also known as a movie composer. So there's a real real theatrical sense to his composing, and it's quite effective.
Mm. I suspect that this production itself brings a lot to bear to this really intriguing story. Just say a quick word about what we will see visually on the stage of the Lyric, and how important a role that plays in the telling of this story, and especially in the conveyance of such a powerfully personal story.
Sure. The stage, it's a really great stage design. There's you see a ship's smokestack, all in white and pristine, kind of the way I would envision a cruise liner to be. And then you have a deck wrapped around the smokestack, once again evoking a ship. And that's about 15 feet in the air on the stage of the Lyric, maybe a little bit more. And it's that's where my scenes mainly take place. A little ship, a little wagon comes in front, and that's our cabin, and we can go up and down the stairs there. But everything is white and pristine. We're everyone on the ship is in white, this very clean palette. And then down below us are the barracks, the Auschwitz barracks, and specifically the female barracks. And it's gritty and dark, and with wagons and rail cars and ovens, and it's a really striking contrast to see the two, the dark oppressiveness of the of Auschwitz, and then this white pristine ocean liner up above, and how this juxtaposition is happening of the two worlds, and actually, you know, her present. Lisa's present, my wife, and her past. Hmm. And it's a really magnificent set.
Wow. It sounds really powerful. One question I had is, you are obviously a very affable, positive guy, and I wonder, what's it like for somebody like you to immerse yourself in a story like this, which at least in many respects is so dark and disturbing? And of course, this isn't the only dark, disturbing opera in which you immerse yourself. But I mean, what does it feel like when you leave rehearsal, or what will it feel like, do you think, when you leave these performances and head back to the farm? I mean, don't you feel like you're sometimes descending into really dark places? And what does that feel like for someone like you?
Oh, definitely. Oh, it's a always a tricky proposition, but this one, even more so. Yeah, I've played many characters that can that kind of have a dark slant, or and I always try to ferret that sort of emotion out, or that idea of a person. I try to find the spots that I think are interesting, and I usually, you know, depending on the opera, the darker the emotion or the past somebody has, the more that I think that's interesting. And for this piece, it was so hard. I would come home, and I have three kids, 9, 12, and 13, and I would come home, and I would just be spent after listening to this music, and the emotions that come with this character, and trying to come to terms with his wife, number one, lying to him over the years, but being a being somebody in, you know, a SS Nazi officer. It was just it's really, really trying. And my wife, you know, more than a couple of times, she said, "Brandon, you know," she goes, "how are you holding up?" And I said, "Honey, you know, I just need to kind of, you know, I just need to take a few minutes and read or get my mind on something else. It really can affect you if you let it." And I do like to immerse myself in a character. And so it was a hard, it was hard at times to snap out of that the emotions that go with it, and to just think what these people had to go through.
Mm.
And it's amazing, and I can't even imagine the horror of it all. And just tapping into just the surface of it in this opera, it really did, it affects me.
Mm. Yeah. We're talking with tenor Brandon Jovanovich. He has one of the leading roles in this relatively unknown opera called The Passenger by Weinberg. It opens at the Lyric Opera of Chicago tomorrow night. Brandon Jovanovich, you are a native of Montana, and we don't think of Billings, Montana as the opera capital of the world. And then when we read that that you were a big football player in high school and went to college on a football scholarship, we sort of strain to imagine whether or not opera was a serious part of your life back then. I mean, in those days, were you also a singer? And if you were a singer, was opera at all in the mix?
You know, it's funny. I was a I would sing around the house quite a bit. My mom always liked to roll chords on the piano, and we'd sit around. And there's I come from a family with three kids, myself and a brother and a sister, but I was the only one that liked to sit there with her, and we'd sing Christmas tunes year round, and a few Broadway numbers, so I've sung since I was started singing when I was four, so nothing, I never was trained or had any voice lessons, anything like that, and then that kind of fell to the wayside when I was about 10 or 11, I imagine, and then I didn't start singing again really until high school, and that was just with a choir. I had no idea what opera was. I had no idea that I had a tenor voice. I always considered myself to be a bass, or at the most a bass baritone. And it wasn't until I went down to college in Flagstaff, Arizona, Northern Arizona University, that I started off as a bass there for more than, I think the first opera I had to sing was, I was a bass, Zoroastro, in an English version of the Magic Flute, and then they thought maybe I was a baritone because I had easy high notes, and then they thought maybe I was a tenor, and I thought my life had crumbled, and that a tenor was pretty much the worst thing that could happen to me, and so it took me a little while, but my voice developed, and it's always retained this darker quality, which lends itself to these more heroic figures that I play today.
Huh. So, yeah. So where you went to school, it was okay to be a football player and a singer in the choir.
Well, you know what, I was only able to play football my first year of college, and then I had to make a choice, and it was I had a full ride scholarship to sing, or I had a partial scholarship to play football. So I took the full ride scholarship to sing, and so that's what ended my football career. but understandable.
Right. So what do you love most about the life of an active opera singer, and what is it that you dislike the most?
Oh my gosh! You know, it's funny that they're kind of one in this. They really play off each other. It's amazing to travel the world. It really is. I get to go to so many places. I've been to China. I've been all over Europe, Ireland, Zurich, Italy, Germany, France. I've sung from coast to coast in the States here, up in Canada. I really get to travel the world and see so many amazing places. And I'd say that's the most amazing thing. Whenever I grew up in Montana, you know, I think I went as far as Seattle. I went over to Minneapolis once and then down to Denver a few times. And other than that, we didn't travel. And so I've just been able to see so much of the world, and that's the most amazing thing. But it also is the thing that takes me away from my family, and I think that's the thing that's the worst aspect of this job, is how much time I spend away from home. And it's one of the reasons we moved out here to just west of Chicago, is I'm able to get to the airport easy. I'm able to fly back on the weekends. They're able to fly out and see me. Depending, you know, we try not to spend that much time away from each other if possible, but with kids in school and such, it's always a challenge. But I mean, it's a really amazing life to be able to expose my kids to so many different places and things. They've seen, I was singing in Switzerland this summer, and this past summer, and the whole family flew over and they saw Zurich, and then we went down to Napoli and saw Pompeii, Mount Vesuvius, went up to Rome, and then ended up in a beautiful, beautiful mountain town called Verbier, Switzerland. I finished a concert there, and then we came home. And it's just being able to expose my kids to so many amazing places and things. It's a real blessing.
And it sounds like now they're getting old enough that they probably better understand what you do, whereas when they were really little, all they knew is that Daddy is gone again. I'm sure that made it even more difficult.
Oh, exactly. For a while there, we moved, after graduating from college, we moved out to New York, and, you know, I was just struggling. My wife was a struggling singer along with myself, and we were out on New York for about 10 years, various jobs, waiting tables, mainly that was it. I was a cater waiter, actually, is what it was, and taking odd jobs here and there, whatever we could do to survive. And then as I started becoming having a viable career, making more money singing than I was as a cater waiter, we ended up putting everything in storage and living on the road from town to town with our two younger kids, or our two older kids now. And it's when the third one came along in about 2006 that my wife said, "We can't live on the road anymore. This is just too tough." So they really grew up traveling with us, going to rehearsals, walking on stage, seeing me in fight rehearsals, or having all these, you know, conflicts on stage with other singers, and relationships on stage with other people, and it really was a fun time in my life and in their life. And as a matter of fact, now on our computer we have all these scrolling pictures from our past, and they look back and they think they remember so much more than I, you know, just through the pictures and their history, they're able to say, "Oh, I remember that place. Oh, I remember going there." And it's amazing. But now that they're getting older, and my youngest guy, he didn't really know that lifestyle. And so now they're able to look, and they really actually enjoy opera, which is surprising. And because at their age, I had no idea the concept. And they are kind of all into it somewhat. So I think it's really amazing.
Just a quick word about the Lyric Opera of Chicago, which in many respects is kind of your home company now. I mean, it's in your back door. Your farm where you live is about an hour away. And of course, they have featured you in some really splendid things. Just say a word about what a strong and wonderful place the Lyric is to work and to sing.
Oh, sure. I mean, it is really my home company. I mean, you know, they've never come out and said that. I've never really come out and said that, but it's true. I work here so much, and I always enjoy coming back to the Lyric. It's one of the most beautiful houses, actually, opera houses that I've been to. It's very Art Deco on the inside, and it as I'm standing on stage, it looks like a huge megaphone extending out into this auditorium. And it's a fan. The people are so enthusiastic, the public, and the people behind the scenes. I mean, that's really what I engage, you know, that's who I engage with every day. And they have just assembled a fantastic group of people to work there. And they're also pleasant. Everyone enjoys the work at the Lyric, and it's like one big family. And I always look forward to coming back to the Lyric and singing. And I'm lucky enough that they do use me quite regularly. It's one of the best places that I've ever worked, and I'm extremely lucky to be there still.
Well, we look forward to seeing you in this latest production in which you're being featured, this opera by Weinberg called The Passenger. Brandon Jovanovich, we wish you well with all that stretches ahead for you. Happy farming, happy fathering, and happy singing wherever your career continues to take you. And thank you for joining me today on The Morning Show.
Hey, thank you so much. It's been a real pleasure.
All right.
And here is the voice of Brandon Jovanovich and the music of Wagner from Die Walküre. This is Jovanovich in the role of Sigmund, singing Winterstürme. American tenor Brandon Jovanovich. He opens the Lyric Opera's production of Weinberg's The Passenger this Tuesday evening. The time is 8:39. You're listening to The Morning Show on WGTD. We're finishing out the hour with antiques appraiser Mark Moran. He is based in Iola, Wisconsin, up around the Stevens Point area. And he is well known for his appearances on the Antiques Roadshow and for the live appraisal events, which he conducts all over the Midwest. In fact, every single weekend for the next several months, he is busy doing such events as the one that he will do this Saturday at the Kenosha Public Museum beginning at 10:30 in the morning, when people, for a very small fee, a portion of which goes back to the museum, can bring in an item to have appraised by Mark Moran. And you're also welcome to come to Saturday's event and just enjoy it as a member of the audience. But if you have something you've long wanted to have appraised, so much the better. Here's a portion of my conversation with Mark Moran, which I asked him about people's high expectations. Sometimes people really inflate the value of an object, which for one reason or another, they really cherish, but maybe harbor false hopes that in fact it might be worth a great deal of money. What's his advice for people? Do they need to tamp down those unrealistic expectations?
You know, I don't want to tamp down anyone's desire to have a rare or valuable object. You know, I like to say that if 10,000 people show up at an antiques roadshow event, and ultimately 10 of them get their treasures featured on the program, those are the right odds. You know, the odds of someone having something rare or valuable or you know incredibly unusual are about 1,000 to 1. But it happens every day, and it happens on a regular basis at my appraisal events. The one that comes to mind is a couple years ago I was doing a program in Prescott, Wisconsin, over on the Mississippi River, just across from Hastings, Minnesota, if people know that part of the world. And a gentleman came into the program, and he had a painting that he had bought at a yard sale for $5. And it was an original illustrator art painting of from a 1950s pinup calendar. So it was girly art, as they call it. It showed a beautiful young woman in a negligee, leaving very little to the imagination, and she was trying to replace an electrical fuse. And of course, she's illuminated in the light of a little flashlight nearby. And so it was a very sweet, sexy, you know, it would have been in a calendar that would have hung in only the finest gas station repair shops, back in the 1950s. And the artist who did it, Harry Ekman, was a pretty well-regarded, pinup artist in the 1950s and early 60s. So the gentleman at the program bought this painting for $5, brought it into the event. I told him I thought it was worth $10,000. And he looked at me like I had two heads. And I said, well, there's only one way to know for sure. You have to put it out on the market. You have to let the market decide what it's worth. You know, sell it at auction. That's the only way to do it. And so he consigned it to auction. He sent it to Cincinnati to be sold by an auction company, Cowan's, one of my Antiques Roadshow colleagues. Wes Cowan runs that company. And this was in 2013. That it went up for auction, and we were on the road with Roadshow. We were in Kansas City or Knoxville or someplace like that, and Wes came over to me, and he had his iPad with him. He said, hey, look at this. And the painting had just sold at his auction for $16,000.
Wow.
And so I was thrilled. Wes was thrilled. The owner of the painting, who bought it for $5, was thrilled. So it was just one of those, wonderful, things that happens, and it happens every single day. It's just that sometimes it takes a while before we, are able to realize what it's really worth.
Hmm. Talk about those moments when somebody comes to you with an item that is of precious value to them and about which they maybe harbor hopes that it's valuable in other ways as well, but need to be told, no, I'm sorry, this is actually just a cheap copy of such and such,
yeah.
Or this is something that there are just so many of them out there that, in fact, this isn't precious in that respect at all. I suspect that one of the challenges in doing these kind of events is how you are going to handle a moment like that, and handle
exactly.
Sometimes the delicate feelings of people with some of their most prized possessions.
Yep, exactly. Well, I've learned over the years how to be as
gentle and diplomatic and as possible when I have to break that kind of news. And it happens pretty frequently, you know, that you know, someone will come in and say, well, my great-grandmother told me to hold on to this because it was really, really valuable. And my response to that usually is, I wish that I had gotten to know great-grandma and been able to talk to her and try and understand why she thought a certain object, you know, was valuable then and would continue to go up in value. The funny thing is that in the last 20 to 30 years, and I know that viewers of Antiques Roadshow hear this over and over again, and it's absolutely true, values for many antiques and collectibles have declined significantly in the last two or three decades. And part of the reason for that is a change in collecting temperament. You know, the younger people are not as interested in the objects that you know, folks started collecting in the 50s and 60s and 70s. And the other component of that is that the quality of the reproductions now is so good. You know, if someone wants a look in their house, something that you know, fits in with their decor and looks nice and presentable and attractive, and you know, they can go to a million places online. They can go to Pottery Barn or Pier One or Ethan Allen and spend more money than what the actual antique would cost, but there's no hunt there. It's instant gratification. And you know, for me and for many people who got into antiques in the 1970s, the hunt was as big, if not a bigger part of the collecting process than the finding. In fact, sometimes when you found something, it was actually anticlimactic to all the fun you had, you know, along the way, going to auctions and flea markets and garage sales and meeting all these crazy people who share your passion for collecting and talking to antique dealers, appraisers, other collectors, auctioneers. It's an amazing, you know, subculture in this country of that I think you know, is maybe fading away. I mean, I used to say that the values for objects was a pendulum. It swings one way and it'll swing back. I don't think we'll ever see some of the values that we saw in the late 90s, and that was really the peak for many, many collecting areas in terms of value.
Let's talk for a moment about Beanie Babies. Only because, I mean, again, that's one of the items that people should not bring to this event on Saturday. I only mention it because I'm pretty sure what's at the heart of that, and I know a lot of really intelligent people who unfortunately got kind of swindled into thinking that they could buy Beanie Babies by the hundreds and bankroll their children's college education. And it seems like that is a cautionary tale on how a lot of people, at that time at least, really badly misunderstood the whole notion of collectability and how an object is likely or unlikely to gain value over time. And I mean, just the mathematics of it. If you have thousands, maybe millions of people buying Beanie Right. Babies and collecting them, by its very nature, those are not going to increase in value. They're going to plummet in value. And of course, that's exactly what the situation is. Is it as simple as that? And how is it that so many people kind of misunderstood that?
Well, I think that from time to time you get these contemporary collectible categories that get very, very hot for a while, but then by their nature they're going to get very, very cold ultimately. And so Beanie Babies is a classic example, but also think back about Cabbage Patch dolls. You know, to a generation or two before that, there were Hummel figurines and Precious Moment figurines and Yadro, the statues and figurines made by the Spanish company called Yadro. There are all of those contemporary collectibles had communities of very enthusiastic collectors grow up around them. They weren't made as collectibles. They had a community that grew up, and so there are companies that saw that and thought, well, maybe we can get in on this collectible craze by producing collector plates that have Norman Rockwell images on them, or scenes from Gone with the Wind, or there were just an endless number of these. But unfortunately, they all call these limited editions, but they're really only limited by the length of time before the machine that makes them breaks down. That's the only thing that limits them. So in the 1970s and 80s, especially, collector plates were just huge. And then, of course, in the 90s, you had the Beanie Babies as well. So these collector areas, contemporary areas, are really more about pop culture than they are about long-term collectible value. Now, who knows what's going to happen in 100 or 200 years? I have a feeling that especially in the case of Beanie Babies, you're not going to see much upward movement. I'm sure that there will be some rare ones. There always are. But in general, they just, it was like printing money. And the more money you print, the more devalued it becomes. And that's what happened with the Beanie Babies. They just kept making, producing them. And you're right. I mean, there's a very famous documentary that you might be able to see online of this family who thought that they were investing, tens of thousands of dollars to help put their children through college. And now they have a house full of thousands and thousands of Beanie Babies that are almost worthless.
I can think of several people I know in my own life, otherwise exceptionally intelligent people who fell into the same trap. And on the other hand, for some people, Beanie Babies were just something fun and a relatively inexpensive way to collect something. I suppose it's even a sadder story when people are maybe spending lots and lots of money on much more expensive items in the mistaken notion that someday these will be extremely valuable. It almost seems like part of the equation is what gains in value is the things that at the time it never occurs to anybody to keep them.
That's true. Ephemera is what we call it. Things that were often, purchased, used, and then thrown away. And so things that survive that process as ephemera can be very collectible today. Advertising cards, comes to mind. Posters, things like that. But my advice is the advice that all good antiques related people stick with, and that is buy something you love. Buy the best example that you can find and upgrade your collection. A collection isn't just an accumulation of objects. It's a changing, association of things and feelings and understanding. And the more you know, and we know this from years and years of experience, the more people know about a specific collecting area, the more comfortable they are spending money. If they're spending money from the standpoint of knowledge rather than ignorance, they're going to be more confident in their buying power. Quality. As long as people buy quality items, they don't have to worry about whether or not they're going to appreciate the best examples of anything out there: glass, ceramics, artwork, furniture, toys. If you buy the best example that you can, you won't go wrong.
I'm speaking with antiques appraiser Mark Moran, who is coming to Kenosha to preside over an appraisal event this Saturday, the 28th of February, at the Kenosha Public Museum. Talking about what's valuable and not valuable when it comes to antiques appraisal, I think for me the aha moment was at some point when I read an article, not in a fancy journal, just maybe People magazine or something, but an article about somebody who had been collecting cereal boxes for years and years and years. And it was just then when I realized, so that's how this works, that in 1965, nobody thinks about saving that Fruit Loops box that no one would ever be interested in having that on a shelf of collectibles. But in 2015, absolutely, there are people who would pay very good money to have a Fruit Loops box from 1965. And the fact that in the moment we don't always know what is going to become valuable someday, that makes all of this a bit of a mystery in a sense.
It really does. And again, that goes to the point of ephemera. Looking at the things that people use and throw away, and by coincidence, someone saved that box, and if it's graphic and colorful and appealing, then someone is going to want to collect it. One way to look at it is everything was once part of pop culture. Everything was new, and the things that have gained in value or gained in popularity, at least, are the objects that that have survived sort of that pop culture phase and have gotten into a kind of an iconic area. I'm thinking, of course, of something like Coca-Cola advertising. The Coca-Cola company has had a genius for marketing its product going back, well over 100 years. And so advertising, good quality advertising today is still a very healthy collecting category.
Mark Moran, he is an antiques appraiser based in Iola, Wisconsin, and he is coming to Kenosha this Saturday, the 28th of February, for a special What's It Worth event at the Kenosha Public Museum, beginning at 10:30 in the morning and actually lasting all day long. And for a very small, reasonable fee, you can register to come and have an item appraised by Mr. Moran at the museum. And by the way, he turns over a substantial portion of that registration fee right back to the sponsoring organization, in this case, the Kenosha Public Museum. So this is actually a lovely and interesting fundraising event for the Kenosha Public Museum and an opportunity for you to have something appraised from your own home. Maybe you wonder about its value or want to know a little bit more about its history, where it came from, where it was made, who it was made by, that kind of thing. There are a few items which you should not bring to Saturday's event. Mr. Moran is not interested in nor equipped to offer appraisals of weaponry, equipped or does not have the background to appraise fine jewelry. And he also would appreciate it if nobody brought anything in the way of Nazi memorabilia and no Beanie Babies. But just about anything else is fair game. And if you have questions about that, you can go to Mark Moran's own website, and you can also contact the Kenosha Public Museum for more information about registration for Saturday's event. Again, it's Saturday, the 28th of February, and the phone number at the Kenosha Public Museum is 653-4140, 653-4140. Or, of course, you can go to the website of the Kenosha Public Museum for more information about this and other events going on there. Tomorrow on the morning show, we welcome back into our studios Professor Art Sear from Carthage College to offer his analysis of a variety of current events. On Wednesday, you'll hear actually more from this conversation with Mark Moran about the business of antiques appraisal. You'll also hear from Rebecca Nation, author of a very interesting book called My Freshman Year, What a Professor Learned by Becoming a Student. On Thursday, we learn more about the so-called Mediterranean diet, which is recommended by many physicians as a promising diet both for weight loss and for general health and well-being. Juliana Heaver is the author of The Vegetarian Diet, the new and improved Mediterranean eating plan. It's a diet which combines the principles of the Mediterranean diet with that of vegetarians and vegans. And on Friday, you'll hear my conversation from 10 years ago with Blair Tyndall, author of a best-selling memoir called Mozart in the Jungle, Sex, Drugs, and Classical Music. The book inspired a much-discussed TV series of the same name, which has just been renewed for a second season. Support for WGTD's Morning Show comes from the generosity of the family and friends of the late Frank and Beverly Falduto, two lifelong Kenosians who devoted much of their lives to the community in general and to WGTD in particular. Mr. Falduto played an essential role in creating WGTD nearly 40 years ago and later served as station manager and occasional Morning Show co-host. We are under a wind chill advisory for another hour until